Hi, I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's to the best of our knowledge, and I want to play a sound for you. See if you can guess what this is. Here's a hint. I'm at the zoo. I'm standing in the Ape House at the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago, looking at and listening to a family of unbelievably noisy, white-cheeked gibbons. So this is a mom, a dad, and three sons. It's lunchtime, and they're swinging wildly from branch to branch, huge, graceful, swooping leaps, and the whole time, they're making this unearthly noise. Now, I don't know if the gibbons are singing to each other, or yelling at us, or what. And it's that unknowability of wild animals that draws us to them. Most of the time, seeing them in a zoo is about as close as we can get. But animal scientists and naturalists are coming up with a few new ways. For instance, ever wondered what it's like to be a badger? Try living in a hole in the ground and eating worms.
When you put a worm into your mouth, it senses the heat as something sinister. You'd have thought it might make a bid for freedom by going down into the deeper darkness that usually means home and safety and head for your esophagus. But it doesn't. It goes for the gaps between your teeth. It thrashes, whirling one end like a centrifuge around the middle of its body. It lashes your gums. Eventually, frustrated, it curls up in the moist space next to the frenulum and considers its position. If you open your mouth again, it'll be off, pressing its tail against the floor of your mouth like a sprinter pushing off from the blocks. This is all disgusting. When you bite into a worm for the first time, you expect the sort of performance that every angler knows, twisting, questing against the hook. But it doesn't happen. Even if, like me, you can't bring yourself to mash the worm with your molars and instead nip it genteelly with your incisors, the main action is crushing. And that seems to be different. Crushed animals just lie. It doesn't seem to hurt. Anyway, both ends of the worm capitulate. And then I can move the worm back and chew it.
This is from one of the most remarkable books of the year, Being a Beast, by the British naturalist Charles Foster. Eating worms, it turns out, is what you do if you are trying to live like a badger, along with digging a hole in the ground and getting in it. Steve Paulson was deeply intrigued, and thank goodness he asked what we are all wondering.
So what did the worm taste like?
Worms taste of the land, unsurprisingly, and they vary according to, as the wine people would say, the terroir.
You mean worms from different areas will taste different?
Yeah, it's unsurprising. They take in earth into their bodies and take the bacteria off those particles, and so you'd expect them to taste of the earth, and so they do. And their slime seems to taste rather different from the body itself, mysteriously, and changes with the seasons.
Now, most people who did something like this would have a really strong visceral reaction of disgust. And, you know, it would be really hard, frankly, for a lot of people not to throw up. Did you have to deal with that kind of thing?
Of course. Yeah, I don't like doing this, but it was more interesting than it was disgusting. Because I had no idea what the land tasted like, and I rather want to know what the land that I walk over tastes like.
So Charles, I mean, the larger project is to try to become like an animal, various different kinds of animals. And so for the badger, you went to the point of digging a big burrow in the ground. You slept there for weeks on end. In fact, you took along your 8-year-old son. What were you trying to figure out here?
Well, I disagree with your description of what I was trying to do.
Okay.
I wasn't trying to be any of these animals. There's a big mistake. There are many mistakes in the book, but there's one big mistake, and it comes right at the beginning. The first line of the book is, I want to know what it's like to be a wild thing. In fact, I don't know anything other than what it's like to be a wild thing, because you and I, however polite and however metropolitan we are all wild things. We've been shaped in the course of our evolution by wild influences. And why do we like sitting by a fire at Christmas time? It's not because we have romantic Dickensian ideas or are smelling the roast chestnuts. It's because at some level of our subconscious, we feel more secure knowing that we can take a brand out of the fire and shove it into the face of the wolf which we're expecting to come. So we are all wild things. So what was I trying to do? I was trying to acknowledge those wild influences on me, and I was trying to see the landscapes that I love in the way that the creatures that know that landscape much more intimately than I do perceive it. Normally, when I go into a wood, for example, I don't see the wood properly and I don't hear what's going on because of all the cognitive tinnitus, which is buzzing in my head.
Right. I mean, sometimes, I mean, for instance, going back to the badger, I mean, what you did when you're in the your own burrow, your sort of badger-like hole, is you're there in the darkness. The most dominant sense that we have, vision, is sort of inoperable at that point. You got to do some other things then.
Right. You didn't even have to be in the burrow to realize that a badger's vision is relatively unimportant to it. If you just drop the 6 feet from your usual level of seeing the world and the 30 million years down to the time when we last shared evolutionary ancestors with the badger, you will find yourself on the floor of the wood and your eyes will be pretty useless. So you will immediately need to engage senses other than your eyes, senses like olfaction, senses like hearing, senses which we have in a perfectly satisfactory way, but which we dismally underuse. So we are pathetically under-sensual creatures. We normally use only our vision and we translate what we see into abstraction. So normally when I'm going through that wood, I'm describing not what the wood is like, but Charles Foster's thoughts about the wood, which are hugely less interesting than what the wood is really like. And I think that's a criticism which applies to lots of nature writing, which is essentially colonial. We come into the wood, we stride manfully into it, and we bring into it all our preconceptions about what that wood should be like. And when we write our nature books, we're describing the contents of our own heads. Very, very boring.
Yes, but can you really do anything else? I mean, when you get right down to it.
You can take steps to do a little bit better. Just sniff and feel, just like children do. I watch my children playing, and you could be forgiven for thinking that humans aren't meant to be bipeds because they're constantly on their hands and knees, physically pushing a lot more of their flesh against the ground than I do when I stride across the world. And they sniff and they hear that they've lost so much less than I have in their contact with the world.
Well, and I got the sense, I mean, reading your chapter on being a badger or being sort of somewhat like a badger, that, you know, you were there with your son, Tom, who was 8 at the time. And
right.
He seemed to be a better badger than you.
Hugely better. And therefore, a much better perceiver of the wood. So he saw the wood much more accurately than I do. He doesn't have all those distorting lenses on when he looks at the wood.
So tell me a little bit about sort of the other senses that kicked in for you. I mean, for instance, smell. I mean, did you develop a more acute sense of smell?
I don't think I developed a more acute sense of smell. I think I became better at paying attention to smell. So our sense of smell is really pretty good. You know, quite a high proportion of us can, for example, detect our own worn T-shirt amongst other worn T-shirts that are presented to us. So just as in all our other areas of life, as soon as we start paying attention to things, we notice them. Why are we satisfied as humans with simply being visual animals, with subjecting ourselves to the tyranny of the cognitive? It's just less satisfactory than acting as a human on all the cylinders that we have.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about your efforts to kind of be badger-like. There is another animal that would seem to be so far from what it means to be human that you couldn't even imagine sort of being anything like it, and that's the swift, the bird that can apparently stay in the air without ever touching ground for 3 or 4 years. I mean, to the point, you know, they eat, they mate, they sleep in the air.
So the swifts which hatch in the eaves above my study in Oxford will go perhaps 4 times to the centre of Africa, to the Congo, without touching anything more solid than the carapace of an airborne beetle in all that time. They won't perch. As you say, they will sleep by spiralling up in the thermals. Yeah, they are part of the air. They graze on these shoals of aerial plankton, which are carried up from the ground. And the attempt to become one of them is ridiculous, almost blasphemous thing to suggest. So, as in the case of all these animals. Now, I wasn't trying to become them, but I was trying to see the world as they see them.
So how do you attempt to try to see the world from the Swift's point of view?
Well, you can try various things, paragliding, climbing to the top of trees, where the top of which, or round the tops of which, the Swifts are feeding. You can try, as I did, to map the swirls of air which are carrying all the insects up from the forest floor. You can try, as I did, manically following the Swifts on their migration across Europe and into West Africa. But all those things really just remind you of what a lumpen, earthbound creature you are. You know, the buckles tug at your crotch. you're fearful of falling off the top of the tree. They just remind you of the massive gulf between you and this piece of air with wings, which a swift really is. So it became a more poetical exercise, really, than anything else.
Charles Foster's book is called Being a Beast. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. I mentioned that I was at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo recently, and one of the things that I noticed when I was there is that what we all of the visitors, really liked best is when the animals did something human-like. For instance, the daily bird demonstration, where the star of the show is a bright blue parrot named Happy Jack.
Well, what do you think of our audience? Yeah, we got a good-looking audience, but, you know, he does think pretty highly of himself as well. Are you handsome? You handsome? Yeah, he's a pretty bird. He does actually know a little song. Do you guys want to hear that song?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right, Happy Jack, let's sing.
I left my heart in
where?
In
nice job. Can you tell everyone goodbye?
See you later.
Hasta la vista, baby. That was Happy Jack, our yellow-headed Amazon parrot.
So I know this is basically a party trick. I mean, I don't think Happy Jack really means what he says, though I don't know, how do I know? But this does say something about how much we wish we could really talk to the animals. The British naturalist Helen MacDonald writes a lot about the interactions we humans have, or try to have, with wild animals. A few years ago, she wrote a book called H's for Hawk. It's a memoir about taming a wild goshawk. She named it Mabel. The book was a huge hit in the UK and here. Helen was back doing another round of book talks recently, and she and I got together to talk about her life after Mabel.
Well, Mabel's become a superstar. You know?
I know, she
when
has.
When I wrote the book, I didn't expect this to happen, but people coming up and sort of saying, you know, oh, you know, she's still around, and I'm saying, no, she's not, but I still have this, a lot of her old malted feathers in a vase on my desk, you know. Oh. She died very suddenly a few years ago of a horrible fungal infection. But yeah, Mabel was a superstar, and people really, really love her.
So these days, I've read you have a parrot, though.
I have a parrot now, it's true. This makes me laugh. My friends have constantly been telling me it's emotionally more healthy to have a parrot because it's cuddly, right? Mabel was lots and lots of things, but she was never cuddly. And I always come back and say that, you know, I've had more scars from my parrot.
Really?
Than I ever had from my hawk. Because although hawks are very heavily armed, they're incredibly honest emotionally. You know, they're very simple beings. They're very solitary in the wild. So if you upset a hawk, it just gets upset and then it forgives you. If you upset a parrot, you're in trouble because it's going to come and get you, right? So when I occasionally upset my parrot, it bites. And yeah, there's a lot of bites and, you know, I love my parrot. I'm having said that, it's a wonderful creature.
But
it's like living
name?
With a person more than a bird. It's called Birdle. You know, Birdle, it just happens.
So I read somewhere you wrote that your parrot is actually vindictive.
Yeah, it can be vindictive. But, you know, everyone can, so. But I think, you know, parrots...
But how so? What does it do?
Oh, it'll remember and get me back later.
Tell that story you told somewhere or other. I can't remember where I read it. The one about the parrot and your mother. She was
trying to feed it. Oh, the lentil. Oh, this is so funny. This is classic, right? My mum and the parrot got on so well. And then one day I went out and my mum was sort of... The parrot's out of the cage all the time, you know. And it was wandering around the sort of table. Mum was having a lunch and she had a lentil salad with vinaigrette on the lentils. And the parrot loves lentils. So she offered one to the parrot, which came over and took this lentil and then went, ew, you know, because it was vinegary and spat it out. This was fine. My mother made the mistake of then picking up the same lentil and offering it again. And the parrot came up, took the lentil, and it was still disgusting. And it dropped it and just stared at her. Like, what are you thinking? And then walked towards her and bit her very, very hard. And that was the end of their relationship. It was terrible.
Does the parrot still not like her?
Well, no, I think what's happened is that my mum's quite scared of the parrot now. And, of course, the worst thing is now that my mother's scared of the parrot and the parrot knows this and the parrot thinks this is hilarious because all it has to do is walk towards my mum looking threatening and my mum will back away. It's heartbreaking.
But I have to say, so I'm listening to this. You're an expert naturalist, you're a scientist, this sounds like gigantic anthropomorphization, doesn't it? Like, but you're attributing all these emotions to the parrot.
Of course
which
I am.
Doesn't have.
I think anthropomorphism is an incredibly interesting thing. And I kind of am worried about the way that it's just routinely dismissed. I kind of believe animals run on emotions. And parrots are particularly interesting like that. I mean, I think this wonderful kind of slightly animistic term of non-human person is perfect for a parrot. These are creatures which live in social groups like, you know, like sort of apes and monkeys. They're very intelligent. They've discovered that some species of parrots give their young chicks names in the nest.
Really?
I mean, scientists call them individual identifiers, but basically names.
But it sounds...
Yeah, it's little sequences of chirps and chips, which the birds will elaborate on, maybe, but they use that name all their lives and they use it to signify each other when they're calling each other.
Wow.
So I think, you know, how can I not anthropomorphize that parrot, you know? I mean, they are, you know, they're people, they're just not human.
So it sounds like one of the things you're suggesting is that we've created this false dichotomy where between our human world and the quote-unquote wild world. And increasingly, the story we tell about the wild, of course, is the ways in which we humans have ruined it.
Yeah.
And maybe as a result, we think the most moral position to take is to stay the hell away from anything wild and away from wild spaces, lest we ruin them all anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very strange situation we find ourselves in. You know, we're basically living through the sixth great extinction right now, you know, caused entirely by us. The world's getting quieter and sadder and more empty all the time. And we're taught that nature is precious. It is. And we're taught that nature, we shouldn't touch it. And I think that's very dangerous. I really
Why?
Do. Well, in lots of ways. You know, for example, in England now, there's a kind of small salamander called the great crested newt, possibly the first time the great crested newt has ever been mentioned on this radio station. And it's very rare in Europe. It's quite common in England. And it's so protected that it's actually illegal for people to put their hands into a pond and drag one out to show their kids. Or
it's illegal even to touch one.
Yeah, yeah. You're not supposed to disturb them at all. And I remember going to a conference once, and this guy in the audience put his hand up and said, "What's the point of protecting them then, basically, if we can't touch them or see them?" And there was an uproar, right? But of course, these animals have intrinsic value for themselves and for their systems. But he made this point and he said, no one's going to want to protect or anything or save anything if they have no knowledge of it whatsoever and they've only seen it in pictures and they can't viscerally go and see it and touch it and learn to love it in the real world. And I've never forgotten that, you know.
I don't know if you've ever seen a wild animal in an urban space, but I've, you know, been walking down my neighborhood street at an odd hour and seen a fox suddenly run across the street, mm-hmm. or once seen a coyote suddenly run across the street. And it's a pretty amazing experience when you see an animal that you think shouldn't belong in your section of the world.
Right. And particularly if they look at you as well. There's been a lot written about the, you know, the animal gaze. You know, sort of John Berger writing about the fact that we usually observe animals. The fact that they can observe us seems to have been forgotten. So certainly when you come across a fox or an owl, it turns its head and looks right at you. There can be moments of real confrontation with your idea of yourself, you know. My most kind of common experience of a very wild animal in an urban setting are peregrine falcons, which, you know, back in the day there were hardly any left because of DDT and shooting. And now they're these really familiar inhabitants of built-up cities, and they live on skyscrapers. And I've talked to people who've said, you know, they've been sitting in their office and they've turned and there's a peregrine falcon sitting on their windowsill looking right at them. And the number of people who've said to me, it was like a religious experience. Here I was in this mundane office, and suddenly there was this wild creature staring right at me, and I felt like I'd been sort of singled out for some special, almost sort of sacred moment. It's really interesting how that happens.
But say more about what you think that is.
Well, that's a lot of things, I think, and partly it's that we don't expect to see wild creatures, very wild creatures, close up, let alone in our office windows looking right at us like the boss is staring through, you know? But also, I think a lot of the wild creatures, like wolves, like hawks, they've had millennia of significant social, religious and mythical meaning for us. And I think those stories about them are still there. We still carry them sort of bubbling along inside, deep down.
Red Riding Hood and the wolf.
Right. Yeah. So when a wolf looks at you or a falcon looks at you, some part of you, you know, knows that there's some significance there which might be more than just, here's a bird on my windowsill, right? If it was a chicken, it would be a different situation.
Well, and to bring us full circle back to what we've lost when we try to make a very clear, sharp boundary between us and the wild, it cuts off that movement, that extension of empathy and sympathy between us and the non-us, I guess is what you're saying.
It does, and it makes the world a lot smaller and less... It lessens it for us, I think. And I know it sounds, I'm sort of saying things that make it sound like it's all about us, but when you surround yourself by things that are like you, and you're in that sort of bubble, the human bubble, and you don't love difference, you love things that are like you, I think that's a great, great shame. And I think a lot of the sadnesses in the world come from that movement of wanting to just be surrounded by yourself. So I get out there. Get out there and watch the spiders and the sparrows in the puddles and, you know, enjoy the wonder of the world.
Helen, thank you. It's a pleasure talking.
And you, I've had a great time.
Helen MacDonald is the author of H is for Hawk and a collection of poems called Shaler's Fish. And meanwhile, back at the Brookfield Zoo, the lions are hungry. The most uncomfortable moment for me at the Brookfield Zoo was at the lion enclosure. There's this huge male lion that came right up to the glass. I mean, he was just inches away from us, and he started pacing back and forth, back and forth. And there's some little kids and their mother there, and the lion at one point just stops, and he stares right at them, unblinking.
Look at him, sharp teeth! Mommy! Mommy, he's looking at you!
I thought, yeah, the lion's looking at you, and he's thinking, hello, lunch.
Maybe he's hungry.
Maybe he's hungry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
he's looking at you.
Oh, yeah, he just licked his chops.
How do we ever know what animals are thinking? I mean, when you see a lion smack its lips while staring at a toddler, you can make a pretty educated guess. But it's a lot harder with an animal that's completely unlike us. For instance, consider the octopus, one of the weirder creatures on the planet. It has no bones, it can shape-shift at will, and as biologists have discovered fairly recently, it's also highly intelligent. But the octopus brain is so alien. Most of its neurons are in its arms, not its head. So how does an octopus think? Well, the Australian philosopher Peter Godfrey Smith lives in Sydney, where the ocean is full of cephalopods. And he told Steve Paulson that encountering some of them in the wild was such a remarkable experience, it led him to reconsider the nature of consciousness.
The encounter with the cephalopods and the octopus in particular really came about, in a sense, partly by chance. I was beginning to spend more and more time just swimming in the ocean, snorkeling, scuba diving, especially around Sydney. And I began to think of them as just the most intriguing things I was seeing in the sea.
Hmm. Was there a particular first encounter that got you hooked on these creatures?
There was, in a sense. The things that I think of as the first encounters that really stay with me were not with octopuses, but with their relatives, the giant cuttlefish, which grows to about 3 feet long, quite a big animal. And there's two things about them which are truly remarkable. One is the ability to change color. They can produce pretty much any color in less than a second. Their skin is a continually changing screen of patterns and colors.
Why do they change color?
Well, no one really knows. It was probably initially for camouflage. So it's at some point in the distant past, cephalopods gave up their external shells, and they had to then avoid being eaten by means of wiles and camouflage. So, for example, you might change color to startle a predator, startle it enough that you can make an escape. The story sometimes told is that they produce very strange color patterns while they're hunting small animals and seem to sort of mesmerize them with the sheer repetitive strangeness of the colors.
Now, you said there were two extraordinary things about the
giant cuttlefish.
That's right. So what's the other one?
The experiences that got me particularly interested in these animals often involve situations where I would come across one of these animals. And you should picture this. Again, it's a big animal, 2 or 3 feet long, with a skin like a television screen and arms a bit like octopus arms, 8 of them coming out of the front of its head. That's a surprising thing to see in the sea.
Right.
And they too seem to find us in many cases as a surprising and noteworthy thing. In some cases, they'll sort of come close and peer at you. They certainly won't run away in many cases. I mean, in a lot of situations where they have every opportunity, if they were scared, to flee, they don't. They just sort of hover and look at you. In a couple of cases, I've reached out a single arm to them, and it's subtle, this behavior. It's not that they sort of obviously reach out an arm and shake hands or anything like that, but they nudge forward an arm to sort of gently touch mine. I don't really understand why they aren't more wary. I think they're genuinely curious about us in a way that a great many wild animals are not.
What I've read about octopuses, sometimes the friendly ones will grab your hand, and it's sort of like they're sucking on you. They're tasting you.
That's what they're doing. That's the right word. They are tasting you. Right. So octopuses in particular, I think this is more an octopus behavior than a cuttlefish or a squid behavior. Right. They'll reach out an arm, and their suckers will attach. They'll touch you. And all of those suckers contain a variety of sensory organs, but in particular, they can taste everything that they touch. If you're in an aquarium situation and you've used particular soaps or deodorants or something like that, you should think of those as, when an octopus touches you, as extremely strong stimuli, as making a big difference to how you come across to them. This is one of several ways in which their sensory world is just completely extraordinary.
I want to back up for a moment and just get a basic sense of how smart an octopus is. What can an octopus do that might surprise us?
They do things, especially in captivity, that are often very surprising. Octopuses have, in several cases, learned to turn out the lights in the laboratory. They learn to squirt water at the bulb, which will short-circuit the light. And they also squirt water at anything they don't like.
Including people, right?
Including people, right. If they don't like
you. I mean, they can recognize people, and for those that maybe they don't like for whatever reason, they'll squirt those people.
That's right. I think that's been seen quite often now. They can learn to remember individual people. So even if the people are wearing very similar clothes, so there's no obvious cues, the octopus can work out who it's dealing with, and it will behave differently to people who've been nice to it than it will to people who have not been nice to it.
Aren't there also some kind of remarkable stories of escape?
They're very good escape artists, that's absolutely for sure. And I think of that as a consequence of several things. One is their sheer strength. It's very hard to put enough weight on the lid of an octopus tank that will really keep the octopus inside the tank. They're surprisingly strong animals and often determined to get out if they possibly can.
So there are stories of octopuses that manage to get out of their tank and they go crawling off, I don't know, trying to get back to the sea or whatever?
Yeah, yeah, they do. I mean, I've seen that myself. If you have an octopus which you're looking at carefully in a bucket or a tank or something, but where there's no lid, so you have to keep an eye on it, if you turn your back for a minute, it's gone.
They're watching you to see when you look away.
That's right. So if you turn your back and then turn again, you'll often see an octopus walking quietly across the floor.
Now, there's one other thing that's truly remarkable about the octopus. Actually, aren't more of the neurons in the arms, the tentacles, than in the brain?
That's right. That's perhaps the biggest surprise. No one really knows, you know, exactly how many neurons an octopus has. The usual figure that people give is about 500 million, which is a lot, certainly larger than any other invertebrate animal. Two-thirds of those are not in the head, between the eyes, in that usual area we think of as the brain area in an animal. Two-thirds of them are scattered through the arms, especially in the upper part of the arms. The whole body is a big control system. It's not the case that you have a kind of a CEO, a kind of executive part of the nervous system in the head telling the rest of the body what to do. You should think of the whole animal as its own controller in a quite different sense than you might apply to us.
So what does that mean, that the arms are not just taking dictation from the brain? Are you saying that the tentacles sort of operate autonomously in some sense?
I think the picture that's emerging is, you might say, semi-autonomously or partially autonomously, with some autonomy. There's a kind of mixture of control. The arms have a kind of exploratory capacity. If you watch an octopus behaving normally, you often see that the animal might seem to be focusing on some particular thing, but one or two arms might just be roaming around in a way that I think probably is largely self-directed.
It raises so many fascinating questions, what you're saying. I mean, like, I'm wondering, does an octopus have a sense of self? Or does it have multiple selves? Is there kind of a self in the arms and a different self in the brain?
One possible view is that once you get the sort of partial breakdown of centralization, the whole notion of a single self just dissolves to some extent. And I think octopuses certainly have experiences. I think it feels like something to be an octopus. When we have experiences, there's a sort of unity to the thing that has the experiences. In the case of the octopus, it may be that that's not quite the right model. I doubt that the right model or the right picture is one in which each arm is its own little self, its own little center of experience. But how we should compare them to the sort of experience that we have, I think it's a very difficult question.
And the reason why you're asking this question is the octopus is very smart, and yet it has a totally different evolutionary history than our closest relatives, mammals, most famously chimpanzees, and even birds. We know that certain birds like parrots and crows can be very smart, but they are also much more closely related to us than the octopus. The octopus has a completely different history.
That's right. There's a big idea here. There's a big fact. The common ancestor of us and these animals lived a very long time ago, probably about 600 million years ago, right back in the quite early stages in the history of animal life. And that branching was so deep in time that you really have a second evolutionary experiment. What does evolution do when it builds an animal with a big nervous system, with a brain that's quite substantial, with quite complex behaviors? Do you get the same thing twice? Do you get something completely different? Do you get something that's unrecognizable because it's so different? You can think of mammals and birds as themselves two little experiments in what you get in evolution when you make a smart animal. But you should think of vertebrates in general and cephalopods as two separate experiments in a much deeper sense.
That's philosopher Peter Godfrey Smith talking with Steve Paulson about his book Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. Coming up, one of the most fateful encounters between a human and an animal, Elena Passarello takes us to Vienna, 1784.
28-year-old Mozart, jaunty in his garnet coat and gold-rimmed cap, strolled into a shop to whistle at a starling in a cage. That bird spat that tune right back at the tunesmith. But not without taking some liberties first. The little songbird unslurred the quarter notes and added a dramatic fermata at the end of the first full measure. And then the starling had the audacity to sharp the two G's of the second measure. Would any Viennese composer worth his wig would keep them natural and in line with the key? Mozart apparently loved this edit because he bought that bird on sight. And for good measure, he drew a little treble staff in his expense book and scored the starling's tweaks under the note of purchase. Vogelstar, 34 Kreutzer, and I'll sing this part. Ya ba 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 ba. And under the last measure, an acclamation scribbled in the maestro's quick hand. Das war schön. That was wonderful.
Mozart's starling, Coco the gorilla, and other famous animals next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We've been talking about animal intelligence this hour, and one of the best books I've ever read about animals is by the essayist Elena Passarello. It's called Animals Strike Curious Poses, a collection of 16 essays, each one about a different famous animal. There's Mozart's starling, Coco, the sign language-speaking gorilla, Yuka, the mummified woolly mammoth found in Siberia. But what this book is really about is people. People watching animals. We've had 39,000 years of looking at and making pictures of animals, and Elena's question is, what does that say about us?
Of all the images that make our world, animal images are particularly buried inside us. We feel the pull of them before we know to name them or how to even fully see them, as if every animal a human brain has ever seen, it is swallowed. We find their outlines as if on Ouija boards, in mountains, and in clouds. Give us a stick, and we'll draw them. Hit a rock on a cave wall until it yields one. Spread them out across the night sky, and we'll point upward. See how they twinkle as they move?
I love that. Elena, I was reading your book the other night, and I read that passage, and I looked up, and I started counting how many paintings of birds or throw cushions with pictures of cats on them I have. I just hadn't realized. You're right. We have pictures of animals around us all the time.
Well, you're a woman after my own heart if your house is decorated with cats and birds. Yeah, and once you start focusing on the ways in which humans have culturally assigned animals to different things, they're just everywhere. Food, especially children's food, iconography of air conditioning repair companies and trucks that pass you by, political symbols, of course, mascots. Here I am in Badger Nation, right? They're everywhere.
And another thing I wound up wondering was, why are so many children's books about animals? And it's not just children's books. It's baby outfits or stuffed animals. Why do you think we fill our children's lives with animals from the time they're tiny?
Well, there's a really interesting essay by John Berger. It was written 40 years ago called Why Look at Animals? And he talks about how we didn't always necessarily have animals as our playthings as children. We didn't necessarily always see our kids as our cubs, but there's something about the contemporary world, he says, where you've got a room of your own with a crib that we want to decorate with things that are precious. And there's some kind of connection between the fuzzy or the delicate or the small or the childlike in the animal kingdom and preciousness now, which is why we have like a teddy bear. I had a rabbit named Tammy that I took with me everywhere that I went. That's one of the reasons. I'm no John Berger, but I also think we probably never feel more like animals or mammals than when we're keeping something close and caring for it. That system of sort of having a cub of our own that's small and watching it, maybe that's a reason that we sort of turn more to the animal kingdom.
It's as though as we grow up, we lose that kind of intuitive connection with animals.
Yeah, the gaze, he talks about the gaze that sort of goes away. We used to be able to sort of share a kind of communicative experience from what we understood when we looked at an animal and then what we didn't. And now, because we're putting animals in these different places, or we were 40 years ago, according to him, we don't have access to that anymore.
Well, you structured this book like a bestiary, one of those medieval compendiums of animals. And I thought we could just go through some of them. So first of all, you made a rule for yourself, right? These would only be animals that humans have named.
Right, yeah. When you say you want to write a book about animals, you definitely have to get more specific because the sky is sort of the limit. So I really enjoy putting limitations on myself. So thinking of a book of beasts in which there's only one entry per species, more or less. But even that wasn't enough limitation for me to move forward. There were still too many. So then I decided that if we'd written them down and named them in some way, there was some name in the historical record, only then would I be permitted to put it in the book.
I love it because it's kind of a history of celebrity animals over the centuries, which lets us think about also how our relationships with animals have changed as you move through the centuries. So let's start at the very beginning with Yucca, the woolly mammoth.
Sure, yeah. Yucca is a semi-juvenile female mammoth who, not very many years ago, fell out of the Siberian permafrost. This is happening a lot with mammoths now.
Because the ice is melting?
That's right, yeah. So Yucca was found, and they found this gash on her back that they thought was maybe the work of a serrated tool. So it wasn't a beast with a claw that split her open. Maybe it was some kind of early human that had something in their opposable thumb that they could use to slice open Yucca's body, which I took to be the first mark, the first naming.
Well, you're also suggesting, I think, that our minds developed from watching animals, so that animals themselves shaped us way back in the early childhood of humans.
That's right. You look all over the planet at the earliest examples of art, and they are more than likely going to be early images of animals. They were the first things we thought to do when we thought about representational imagery. I just think that's so beautiful.
There's another passage, actually, I was going to ask you to read.
Oh, sure.
You're describing one of those early cave painters.
Yeah, sure.
Great.
13 millennia after Yucca, a woman, the first known shaman, will lie in a grave with a fox in her arms. Above her body, they'll cross two mammoth scapula and dust the bones with yellow-red ochre. Around her, they'll bury a collection of clay, the first known ceramics fired into dog shapes, bear shapes, horse shapes, and also the shapes of mammoths. Around the same time, if there is even any reason to call this time, a hunter will walk to a river cave alone. Though he's watched animals all his life, he won't hunt them today. Instead, he will search for a giant limestone arch. The arch looks like a mammoth leaping over the river from rock to rock. Go now. Go and collect them. Collect them all in a cave, hidden by a river, under a leaping mammoth of limestone, where the floor goes 500 years between sets of human footprints. Collect the lion, the rhinoceros, the ibex, the oryx, the cave bear, and the lion and the wolf. Collect them in charcoal and ochre and on the sharpened ends of pine boughs. But put the largest animals, the ones held inside the hunters with the deepest reaching memories, way in the back of the cave. Find them in the way back darkness, where giant bears go to die. And that all comes from that Werner Herzog movie.
Yes, about the Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Yeah. I feel like I was there, though, from that film. He really filmed it so beautifully. It was so arresting, so perfect.
Of course, you're writing this book during the sixth great extinction, which I imagine that must have been on your mind. How did it affect your thinking about animals?
I think it's a result of the shock of learning about how quickly all these animals that were in the crib with me, these stuffed animals, if I, you know, have a child, those stuffed animals are going to represent mythical creatures. One of the things that made me do is to stop paying attention to what they call the charismatic megafauna. I thought this book was going to be all tigers and rhinoceroses and stuff, and look at these smaller creatures who are probably going to be alive into the sixth extinction, and cherishing starlings who have kind of taken over the North American continent, even though they're invasive, spiders, rats, and pigeons, creatures that I knew were going to be close by for the rest of my life, or if I had a kid that I could get it a pigeon stuffed animal and it would probably still be there when it became my age. And trying to learn more about them and get to know them as kind of peers. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you have a favorite animal in the collection?
I like Mozart's starling, the starling that Mozart bought. And he said, I bought a starling today. And then he wrote a little line of music. So we think that he went in and saw this starling, and the starling sang a kind of functified version of a piece that he was working on. And it delighted him so much, he had to bring the bird home. And then we know that that bird stayed with him for three of the most prolific years of Mozart's life. And then he threw this elaborate funeral for the starling when it died. It was a needed moment of lightness.
Didn't he actually write, he and the starling together, or he wrote a little piece?
I don't think so, but he wrote the musical joke then, which is, you know, he wrote all these silly joke pieces to play at parlor games and parties, and it's got these kind of junked melodies that sound like what happens when a starling will take a melody, like your doorbell or your hairdryer or the theme from the news program that you watch, and just sort of kind of mess with them, kind of Thelonious Monkify them a little bit. So some people think, and I like to think, that some of these funkier turns in the things that he was working on for those 3 years maybe came from this funny little bird that he kept with him. We'll never know for sure, but we know he loved the starling, and we know that he imagined when the starling died, the starling looking down on him and approving of the fact that Mozart was continuing to make beauty and compose in this sort of cheeky way. So that makes me think that they were maybe collaborators.
Elena Passarello. Mozart's starling is just one of the essays in her collection, Animals Strike Curious Poses. And there's another one that she read on stage the night she was here, which is actually one of the funniest readings I've ever heard. Though it's definitely on the risque side. You'll see what I mean.
Okay, so this is the last essay I wrote for the book. It takes me about 5 minutes to explain why I wrote it and 2 minutes to read it out loud. But I was saving one animal for the very end, Coco, the sign language gorilla. Are we familiar? She was very, very funny. Coco's kind of great. She calls all women lips. And it's like, you, lips. And then when she goes to bed to make her feel safe, they draw these drapes around her enclosure. So when she doesn't want to talk to you anymore, she just goes drapes. She just talks to the hand. So here's Coco telling the vaudeville joke, The Aristocrats. Do we know? Do we know? Okay, I told you, yeah. The Aristocrats is this kind of shaggy dog story that comedians often tell behind the scenes. The premise is a guy walks into a talent agent's office and says, I have a family act that's just going to blow your socks off. And then the father begins to describe the most disgusting acrobatic sex act, you know, whatever the comedian can come up with. And some people have told this joke for like 4 hours straight, and it's like strange and involves a lot of it's like Cirque du Soleil, but gross. And then when the talent agent is like, has this barrage of like graphic imagery has been thrown at him, he asks the father, so what do you call your act? And he goes, The Aristocrats. So Coco the gorilla tells a famous joke. Father gorilla, mother gorilla, baby gorilla hungry, need work. Mustache man tell, what work? Father gorilla tell, really together show, fine show, good practice, lights off good. Mustache man tell, hurry, tell me. Father gorilla tell, hello do mother gorilla, hello do father gorilla, together dance, clap people. Father gorilla harmonica, mother gorilla clown time, clap people. Hello do baby gorilla, skateboard do, puppet dance do, clap people.
Father gorilla kiss, mother gorilla kiss, gorilla hug, mother gorilla nipple find, clap people, nipple kiss, nipple rub, nipple pinch, nipple slap, nipple on bottom, nail clipper, nipple many, many, nipple touch, tongue nipple, nipple sandwich. Mustache man tell who nipple? Father gorilla tell all nipple. Now, father gorilla, mother gorilla, peekaboo pickle, poke stomach. Peekaboo pickle with pat bottom, with walk up my bottom, pull out hair, mat nasty time, mean love, mother gorilla leash on pickle, skateboard ride do, clap people. Mother gorilla find baby gorilla, little noodle pull, zip mouth, strangle tadpole, mayonnaise necklace, father gorilla there, sit father gorilla, thirsty father gorilla, lick mother gorilla, strap on, baby gorilla sit mother gorilla, oh peekaboo pickle, trouble pickle. Baby gorilla get Ingrid. Hello, do Ingrid. Ingrid turn around, baby gorilla wrestle. Ingrid, trouble. Devil, Ingrid, you bad, dirty toilet. Ingrid, psh, psh. Ingrid pudding do. Ingrid laugh. Ingrid eat. Ingrid sick. Mother gorilla taste. Bottle, match. Ingrid electric pudding. Ingrid get father gorilla. Pickle, bottle, match. Peekaboo, pickle on fire now. Ingrid.
Almost done, almost done. Ingrid whole smoke ring blow. Mother mother gorilla whole blow harmonica. Father gorilla dance, balloon on noodle. Baby gorilla clown time, balloon on tadpole. Ingrid whole smoke smoke. All around together, skateboard do, smoke noodle, balloon harmonica ride. All harmonica holes play purple rain. All mayonnaise rain. All finished. Thank you. Mustache Mantel. Wow, what name show. Father gorilla tell, we wonderful snob people. Mustache man smile frown. Drapes.
And that is the one and only Elena Passarello. Her essay collection is called Animals Strike Curious Poses, and thanks to Reading Group Choices for bringing her to town and letting us record. So if you also like live events with writers and storytellers, then get your tickets now to see To the Best of Our Knowledge live on stage in Milwaukee. We'll be there April 19th doing a show about water and identity. Why? Because Milwaukee sits on one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the world. Who owns it? Who gets it? And what happens when the rest of America wants it? Come defend and celebrate water rights with us. We'll have conversations, storytelling, and live music. You can find out more and get those tickets at ttbook.org/live. Hope we see you there. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Halima Shah. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. And I'm Anne Strange-Champs. Thanks for listening.